CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm City AM's Andy Sylvester. Today we've got a bumper double episode with two topics close to my heart: mental health and the future of journalism. In a little while, I'll be joined by Jeanette Makings, Head of Financial Inclusion at Close Brothers. We're going to talk about the pandemic and the miserable impact it has had and continues to have on people's mental health. And we'll also ask what employers can do to let their staff know that they care. But first, I'll be joined by Rebecca Vincent, Reporters Without Borders Head of Campaigns. She and her team focus on press freedom here and across the world. Whilst as a no-good hack, I'm obviously partial to anybody telling me how important journalism is, it is at the heart of democracy. And whilst nobody's pretending any of us are perfect, when you look at who has done the most to hold the government's feet to the fire over the pandemic in this country, it's been the media, frankly not the opposition, that have done most of the hard yards. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. Why don't we kick off? I think, you know, obviously everybody's familiar with Medicine Sans Frontières, but what do Reporters Without Borders do?
Well, actually, we were born of the same movement in France in the 80s as Médecins Sans Frontières. So in a way, it was that sort of concept of, you know, although our substantive issues are very different from theirs, that cutting across borders for things. So we defend press freedom all around the world, in essence. And, you know, that can take on different forms in different countries, but it's defending journalists and citizen journalists and media workers anywhere they're under attack. We do so through a range of methods, sometimes through big public mobilization campaigns, and I work on the campaign side, so that's more my focus, but also behind the scenes advocacy with states, with international organizations, and very concrete things too, like from Paris, journalists can borrow flak jackets and helmets to go off to war, or we run a freelance insurance scheme, for example. We provided emergency assistance in cases of journalists who need to get out of harm's way. We might sometimes help people resettle in a safer country or try to get them some funding for medical assistance or legal assistance. We also provide training, whether that's digital security, physical security. So sort of the full range of support, really, for journalism and for journalists around the world.
Yeah, and unsurprisingly, the sort of thing that goes down very well with journalists like me. That's why we're here today. I think just thinking about kind of press freedom and openness and transparency, there's always been a theory that, you know, the arc of history tends to bend towards better things, and one assumes that it will always bend towards sort of more press freedom, more freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. But the research that you guys do suggests that that isn't the case, and not just in, you know, quote unquote autocratic, you know, places, but in democratic places as well.
Absolutely. And so, you know, each year we put out the World Press Freedom Index, which is a really useful tool throughout the year, actually. It provides a snapshot of the press freedom situation in 180 countries. And so you can see how countries are ranked in comparison to each other, but you can also click through and see how a country is performing against itself over time, because there's scoring and you can see different criteria for how we measure the situation everywhere. One thing that you don't get at a glance from looking at our index is that the whole world is getting worse year by year. So you can see, you know, movements within the index. And in fact, you know, we tend to focus on those who are doing poorly, but there's always some success stories in the index too. Each year there are some countries who show political will to actually implement reforms and move up too. But overall, the situation for a number of years now, I think since 2016, has been that the global score has gotten worse and worse. And Europe in particular, which has historically and still is the region that performs the best, that respects press freedom the most, it's slipping too. So when even our democratic standard setters are failing to meet our own standards, it creates a situation of a sort of race to the bottom, because more authoritarian places, you know, the leaders will notice this, often will point to it as an excuse. And so, you know, we all have to do better. I think that's the quick takeaway, is that there's room for improvement everywhere. And I, as a campaigner, really, I spend nearly as much time talking about the situation in the UK and the US and our own democracies as I do also in some of the worst offenders, the countries at the very bottom. So I think we're stronger when we hold ourselves to account as well. And it is a really worrying time for press freedom and for journalism everywhere.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. Let's just talk about the UK briefly, because I think, you know, probably outside of journalism, it looks like the sort of place where you can opine and are free to report on any and all. But in the UK, we've got our problems as well, right?
Oh, yes, we have. And I should mention, we have also one of the most robust media climates in the world. We have some amazing journalism coming out of this country, some really troublemaking journalists here too, holding our government to account. But there's been a number of worrying policies and practices. Reporters Without Borders opened our London bureau in 2016. That's when I came to the organization. So since then, we've had a really in-depth ability to analyze the situation here. And our scoring and ranking will fluctuate a little bit year to year in the World Press Freedom Index. This year, we're 35th out of 180 countries. But frankly, it's not good enough. You know, we should be doing better. Many countries around the world still look to the UK as a standard setter for these issues. So of particular concern this year, we've pointed to the situation in Northern Ireland in particular, where safety of journalists is a really pressing concern. Luckily, over the past year, nobody was killed. But of course, the year prior, we saw Lyra McKee killed in the line of duty, observing rioting in Derry. Last year, the snapshot year for this index, we didn't see anything that extreme, luckily, but we saw a lot of active threats against journalists covering organized crime and paramilitaries in particular, disproportionately affecting women journalists too. So there's a really concrete situation with safety of journalists in Northern Ireland. There have been a number of worrying trends with regard to freedom of information throughout the UK, including some brilliant reporting by Open Democracy, which exposed this kind of secretive clearinghouse under Michael Gove's purview that seems to be kind of filtering out FOI requests and deciding what any government body should be able to respond to and who. And in fact, we've seen reports, not just in that regard, but with other FOI issues as well, of certain media being blacklisted, right, which is worrying. And a case I have to mention, which is always a polarizing one, but Julian Assange, who for Reporters Without Borders, the implications of his case are alarming for press freedom and for journalism in this country and internationally. Of course, it's the US government that's brought the case against him, but the UK currently has him detained at Belmarsh Prison, whilst the US pursues an appeal against the extradition decision. Of course, the court in January found that he should not be extradited to the US on mental health grounds. But he remains detained in this high security prison whilst the US government plans its appeal. So we call on the US to close the case and would very much call on the UK to consider its decision to keep him in prison where he remains at risk in terms of mental health, physical health, and other issues.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's certainly a polarizing figure. And I think, dare say, many listeners will possibly think differently to you on the actual merits of that case. But yeah, you're right, the principle was essentially reporting and opening up things that governments didn't want you to know and telling the world about it, which, you know, as a principle is something that I think, you know, we have to remember, even though some people may have their own personal views on Assange himself.
But it's not about whether we like him or anybody else we defend, right? It's about what's at stake. And he would be the first publisher prosecuted in the US under the Espionage Act, which could have a serious chilling effect on national security reporting around the world for years to come.
Yeah, and as you say, if we are measuring, if autocratic countries are measuring themselves and seeing how far they can push based on what, you know, so-called open democracies are doing, then of course that's going to have an impact. Let's talk quickly about the current campaign you're running around Maria Ressa.
Maria Ressa is an amazing woman and a fantastic and courageous journalist. In fact, one of the most inspiring people I have ever met. She is the founder and CEO of Rappler, which is an independent media outlet in the Philippines, a country with a very worrying press freedom record as well. Maria is not imprisoned, luckily, yet, but she is facing at least 9 cases opened against her and Rappler, which if she is convicted and sentenced on all of those charges, she could be looking at a lifetime in prison. She's been convicted on one already. We call it cyber libel one because there's now 2 additional cyber libel cases amongst those 9 charges. She was convicted on that charge last summer. If that is not overturned on appeal, that charge alone could have a 6-year prison sentence with it. And she seems to be square in the sights of the Duterte regime. You know, she's being targeted really for her independent reporting on issues that they'd like to keep hidden, critical aspects such as their war on drugs and the true human cost of that. So we've come together as Reporters Without Borders with the Committee to Protect Journalists and ICFJ as well. We formed the steering committee of a bigger campaign called the Hold the Line Coalition, because Maria has been calling for years to hold the line for independent media in the Philippines. So now there's more than 80 organizations supporting this campaign around the world. And we recently launched a really cool online protest, which will, in fact, it will serve as a continuous protest in support of Maria, in support of Rappler and independent media in the Philippines until all of the charges against her are dropped. It's a nonstop loop of supporters around the world speaking out in her, you know, for press freedom, for you know, these very values that Maria is taking a stand for, and for Maria herself. So there's the website Hold the Line for Maria Ressa, where anybody now can add a short or long video if they wish of themselves speaking out. It will be added to this continuous loop, and it will be that continuous protest until these charges are dropped. But we remain really concerned for Maria, not just as a person, but for what she represents. And if the Duterte regime is successful in imprisoning her or silencing Rappler's reporting, that will have really worrying implications, not just in the Philippines, but globally, because this is a war for freedom of information, for freedom of expression, for press freedom. And so we very much stand fully behind Maria and her courageous colleagues in the Philippines.
A war for press freedom is something that I know which side of the fight I'm going to be on that one. Thanks so much for joining us, Rebecca. I hope the campaign goes well for Maria, of course, but more broadly, important work in defending our ability to hold the powerful to account. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Andy.
That was Rebecca Vincent. And now I'll move to my second guest this week, Jeanette Makings, Head of Financial Inclusion at Close Brothers. Now, we all know that the last year has been tough, very tough at times. Money worries add to that too, of course, so we'll dig into what employers can do to help their teams make smart decisions outside the workplace too. Jeanette, good to have you here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Hi, Andy.
Hi, yeah. We've obviously, I mean, a global pandemic was not on anybody's forward planning diary in 2020, in January 2020. But we've talked a lot about physical health, unsurprisingly, and the effect of the virus on this podcast. And of course, everybody's been thinking about it. But I think we're probably getting to a point now where mental health and the impact of the pandemic, we can now almost safely discuss looking back at it. Yeah, you've obviously done a huge amount of research into how employees of firms right across the piece are feeling. What has that shown you beyond just the fact that, you know, as we all know, the last year has been a bit of a stressful one?
So I think research is gives us great insight about lots of things. And in fact, we were incredibly lucky, fortunate in with our timing, I suppose, that we do research approximately annually anyway, looking at the workplace and well-being in the workplace, with a particular focus around financial well-being, but also the codependency on the other aspects of well-being, like mental health and physical health as well. So we were incredibly lucky that we did a piece of research at the kind of the beginning of the first lockdown in 2020. We published that research in May 2020. And that really looked at the sort of trends in financial well-being. So this is something that's been talked about for a long time. We wanted to see what had changed and what had progressed. You know, what were we seeing as those sort of longer term trends? But as well as that, we had some research that was published very recently in May of this year, 2021. And that really gave us the opportunity to almost, well, I'd like to say bookend the pandemic, but that's maybe a bit too ambitious. But certainly to have a look at what we were seeing at the beginning of the first lockdown and what we're now seeing now in May 2021, and really what that's done to change people's behaviours, that how they're feeling with regard to their health overall, that's physical, mental and financial. And really, are there any sort of lasting changes that are going to come through at the other side of this around changed behaviours with regard to their workplace and their health?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating stuff. And I mean, you know, obviously what we've seen with those two bits of research is broadly that as this pandemic has dragged on, people have been more worried about their mental health, more aware of their own mental health. And a lot of people clearly, you know, from your research found not just the 12 months, but maybe just this winter just gone, very difficult combining, I should say, work stresses with financial health, etc.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, really, everyone's had a lot to cope with, and they've had a lot of change to cope with. And they've also had things, you know, very worrying things to cope with, and things that nobody could really have prepared for before. And I think that preparation point, you know, what's the definition of a crisis, or what's the definition of an emergency? These are things that perhaps can't be expected or can't be prepared for fully, but for which, you know, a little bit of preparation may give you a head start. So I think it's really apt for us to be talking about this. We're in the middle of Mental Health Awareness Week. And I think, you know, dealing with such really difficult things that people have had to deal with over this last 14 months, you know, people have lost their livelihoods. Some people have had their, you know, financial worries because their income have been reduced. But people have also had their health impacted, and they've lost loved ones. So, you know, really serious issues all the way around, really, and for us to imagine that isn't going to take a toll somewhere on the nation's health in every aspect of that, both on our purse and on our wallet, and on our physical health potentially, and on our mental health. I think when we talk about that, we always focus on the worst, you know, the worst things that have happened. But actually, we've seen through this research there have been some positives coming out of this. You know, I think during the lockdown, people were given more time, perhaps people who were on furlough, they could make some changes, they could evaluate their situation, they were spending less, they were spending more time with loved ones, and actually it caused some people to reflect, review and reset. So I think it's also about recognizing, for example, you know, yes, we've seen a 51% increase in people worrying about mental health. Yes, we've seen from the research 39% people increasing their worries about their finances. But we've also seen 57% of people saying they have already, or they plan to make changes to their finances. And we know that money worries are a component of stress and anxiety, which then builds into mental anxiety and mental health issues.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think one of the, a drum that I've been banging for an awfully long time during this pandemic is the sort of outsized impact the pandemic and the associated economic slowdown alongside has hit, you know, younger people in the economy, 18 to 30 year olds. Awful lot of the job losses have been concentrated in that area. An awful lot of those on furlough are in that area, and that's going to take a tremendously long time to catch up on. You know, people that start their careers who have, you know, sort of been had a year stolen away from them, I guess, in terms of career progression, or indeed, as you say, jobs lost as well. You know, if you're an employer and you've been able to keep those young people, you know, we all know it's been tough, and it's been tough for employers as well. It's tough for managers. Managing remotely, you know, if you're an employer, what are you looking out for? What should you be doing to speak to those young people who have been hit hard? Maybe they haven't had salary go up in the way that they were hoping to. Maybe they are struggling with rent in a bigger city, etc., etc. As an employer, you know, bearing in mind it is tough out there, you can't just, you know, make financial health worries go away with a pay rise. You know, what should you be doing there as an employer? What would you say?
So I think. There are some really sort of simple things that can be done. And this applies not just for young employees, but it applies for everybody. And I think you know, great communications, reminding people that you're there to help, reminding people about the benefits that already exist in their workplace as an employee, reminding of the support that's available to them as an employee. So, for example, if there's an employee assistance program, if there are some mental health first aiders, you know, having that dialogue as open and frank and continuous as possible. So this is not just a one-off thing in Mental Health Awareness Week or Financial Awareness Week. This is a continuing dialogue, an open dialogue to remind people of the resources and the benefits that are available there that could help them. For example, some employers may have discount schemes that all of their employees can use to help reduce some of their regular costs. You know, things like this, just reminding them what's there. That's kind of step one, really, I think, and that open dialogue. Step two is really helping people, giving them access to really good support to help them understand what's in front of them and to help them make the very most of that that's best for them individually, and to also make them better informed and more resilient to what's available outside the workplace. Employers can do a fantastic job at protecting their employees and supporting their employees inside their workplaces, but it's key to also make them resilient to enable them to make good informed decisions for everything outside the workplace too. So as part of that, a fundamental part of that is financial education, is really helping people, giving people the tools and the models to understand what's in front of them, to make best use of that for their own personal finances, and to build their skills and capability and resilience for making good decisions outside the workplace as well.
Yeah, that's such a big thing, and especially even small employers. You know, you can do a lot of work just signposting that, these are where you can go. If you don't have the resource yourself, you can still do that signposting work. Just thinking more broadly, taking sort of a step back about, you know, as you say, Mental Health Awareness Week, et cetera, a tough year. You know, where do you feel we've got to in the sort of mental health journey in the UK and in employment? Because it seems to me that there is, you know, more of a focus on it than ever before. And I think the vast majority of employers, vast majority of managers want to be good in this space. They want to support their employees as much as they possibly can. But sometimes still don't always know the language and don't always know the difference between, you know, bad mental health and the average stress that comes with working in a high pressure environment. Do you think we, in terms of how managers think about this, not just how employees think about their own mental health and are open about it, do you think employers have got to a good place in the journey? Where do we go next, do you think?
So I think this is a really good point. I think if we break down well-being into, and this is, it is a simplification, but it's a broadly accepted simplification. If we break well-being down into three simple component parts, physical, mental, and financial, I recognise that financial is creeping up the priority list, but it's still the sort of the forgotten cousin in those three. Physical well-being has been very well established over 100 years. There's legislation, for health and safety at work, for example. So there's been a lot of practice insightful for employers, for organisations to help protect their employees and keep them safe at work. I would say certainly in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there's been a growing recognition around mental well-being. And I think that's around the development of UK PLC, if you like, moving more to service businesses than manufacturing in some senses. Of course, we are still a fantastic manufacturing country as well. But, you know, we've moved away from sort of, kind of more towards how do we get the best out of our workers? How do we support them in giving of their best, in being happy at work? And therefore that recognition that an employee who can, employ their whole self at work in the most productive way is going to be better for the employee and is also going to be better for the business performance. And that's where I think there's been that much greater focus on mental well-being and supporting that mental well-being. And that's about riding that difficult balance between giving challenges and having, good stretching expectations of employees to give them satisfaction at work, whilst also walking that balance between giving them something that's beyond their skill level or capability and causing them undue stress and them having work-related stress. So I think that's always the balance that every organisation walks and every manager in that organisation walks. But I do think there's been a huge increase in recognition for training management to help with that, in recognising that, in supporting that. I think there's been some fantastic research done. I think there's some great organisations like Mind, for example, who are putting, you know, much greater resources into recognising and helping that. So I think there's a lot more out there, and I think we're all still on that journey to becoming better at it. It's not something you kind of achieve. It's something you constantly strive to achieve better at. But I think in the same way, you know, as the world is changing, as we've all found with the pandemic, with different challenges and different changes to our lives, we have to adapt, and we have to recognize that we have to adapt our support networks and our management styles to help our teams adapt in the same way.
Yeah, and of course that's going to be a real challenge, especially in, you know, if we do move to a world of hybrid working, or indeed more working from home. That adds another layer of sort of complexity, but as you say, we are going to have to adapt. Jeanette, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been really enjoyable. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
And that's all from us at the City View podcast this week in partnership with CMC Markets. See you next week.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently.
76% of retail investor accounts lose money.